Okay, welcome everybody, and thank you for attending the webinar. I'm Eric Elmore of Drucker & Scacchetti, and we're an accounting firm with a specialized practice in taxation. And again, thanks for coming on. I'm going to just switch it on over to Peter Longstreth, who is going to introduce the Consular Corps, who are our gracious hosts for this program. Peter?
Eric, thank you very much, and welcome to our audience, wherever they may be. And let me start off with a very sincere hope that everyone is safe and healthy in these somewhat challenging times. By way of a broader introduction, the Consular Corps is the oldest consular association in the country. And today, we are proud to have 65 members representing countries all over the world. Any number of those members serve significant populations from their countries in Philadelphia. And all of us are very much involved in developing relationships, whether they be business, cultural, healthcare, higher education, whatever they might be, between Philadelphia and the countries that we represent. In addition to those 65 consular members, we also have 50 associate members. And these are leaders from Philadelphia's business, nonprofit, and government sectors that have all of them a very special interest in international engagement. So today we're delighted and really honored to have with us two representatives from our associate membership group. They are, as you have heard, Drucker & Scacchetti, a prominent accounting firm with a specialization in taxation, and Green & Spiegel, a Philadelphia-based law firm with a specialization in immigration law. We're really delighted to hear from them, their observations and their insights, particularly during these unusual times. So thank you for being with us. And let me hand it back to Eric for the proper introduction.
Thanks, Peter. And we're going to just talk a little bit today about immigration and taxation in the United States resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic, a number of pieces of legislation and some other changes at various top areas of the government have made some changes in these laws, temporary or not. And we've got some great experts to go over them today. So, but before we get started, I'm gonna cover a couple of housekeeping items. One, we're gonna have three 20 to 25 minute segments today. The first one will be on immigration. The second one will be on taxation. And then the third will be the Q&A session. At the bottom of your screen, for those of you who are not familiar with Zoom, there is a Q&A icon. And throughout the presentation, you can submit your questions there. We will not get to them until the end, until both sets of speakers have spoken, but we will, as time allows, try to get all of your answers, all of your questions answered by our speakers. As attendees, you are on mute for the program. This will maximize the time our speakers have and eliminates any unintended audible disruptions. We'd appreciate you sticking to that. We are recording this session, and it will be made available by the Consular Corps on its website sometime after this. So for those of you who know folks who wanted to get online and could not, you can share that with them by having them go to the Consular Corps website. And I'm sure Peter will make some kind of announcement when that is available. The contact information for our speakers will be in the email that follows this program, immediately following the program. So if anyone wants to contact them about issues that they may have for themselves, clients, or constituents, you'll be able to do that. And with that, let's get started. So our first speaker is attorney Jonathan Grode. He's the U.S. Practice Director of immigration law firm Green & Spiegel, also an associate member of the Consular Corps. And after Jonathan speaks, we'll move into taxation. And that will be by Joanne Young and Steve Braun, both CPAs and leaders of the international tax practice at Drucker & Scacchetti. So with that, Jonathan, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Eric. Thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you today. So immigration, right? There's a lot of challenges going on with global mobility right now. Obviously, the efforts that countries are making around the world in restricting travel is done for the health and safety of the global community. However, the United States, in the way that they've been handling immigration and migration to the United States for those that have been in country and may have been stuck here, or those that are outside the United States and trying to migrate back to be with family members or to assume work, has been somewhat challenging. And as many of you may have heard, there is a lot of conjecture of future executive orders from the administration that actually could come out as early as today that are going to be provided with the justification of the high unemployment rates in the United States as a means of restricting people using visas. So we are in a very challenging time as immigration has not only been utilized for protecting the country from an expansion of the pandemic, but is also being used in some respects for political purposes. And balancing that and serving our constituents and people that want to be in the United States has become a tremendous challenge. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a factual background as to what's going on right now. And then we can talk a little bit about what is anticipated to come up in the next week or so. And then obviously, as Eric mentioned, we'll have time for some Q&A at the end. But right now, all visa operations outside of the United States have ceased. Embassies and consulates around the globe from the United States are not processing new visa requests. There are exceptions. You can request emergency travel permission through the embassy, and you can also request the adjudication of visas for emergent purposes, most notably for individuals that are coming to the United States to help fight the pandemic and to provide health and human services or ancillary related services to the United States. What's interesting is that we had expected a lot of embassy activities to resume on June 8th. That did not happen. The justification given by the Department of State is one of reciprocity, saying that other countries are not opening up their doors to the United States and therefore we are not going to do so as well. In addition to a lack of visa processing itself, we have a number of travel restrictions already in place. Now, if you look at it, some countries, it's very fascinating. Some countries have taken a different approach to ensuring health and safety of their population. For example, Canada has a 14-day mandatory quarantine when you enter the country. If you are coming in for a very specific purpose that is deemed to be an exception across the U.S.-Canadian border, you have to have a plan in place as to how you are going to quarantine for 14 days. Australia has taken that a step further. They have a government-controlled quarantine where after arrival, even if you're an Australian citizen, you have to go to a hotel that is being paid for by the government and remain there under their watch for 14 days. The United States has not taken such a systematic approach to people arriving in the United States and instead has issued travel restrictions to certain countries. Right now, those travel restrictions exist for China, which was the first travel block that was put into place by the administration. And you may have heard the administration touting that as an early response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The EU and the UK, as well as Ireland, Canada, and Brazil all have, Canada has the border issue, but and Brazil, as well as Iran, say that if you've been in any of those countries for the last 14 days, you're not allowed to come into the United States. So those travel restrictions in and of themselves are very challenging. We have been working with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania on some very specific instances that are deemed to be important for the economic activities of the region, where we are seeking waivers of the 14-day requirement through Customs and Border Protection's regional headquarters in Baltimore. Those have been met with varying degree of success based on the economic impact and need for the individual to arrive. But there is a waiver process in place, which is really important to recognize. If you do have somebody who needs to get to the United States, there is a way to get that permission. In addition, as previously mentioned, you can seek that waiver through an embassy or consulate by applying directly for a visitor visa classification. But that requires additional hoops, because not only do you have to book the appointment, then you have to get that appointment expedited so that you can actually appear, because as mentioned, those functions are technically closed. Then they also have to grant you a waiver on top of it. And the timing that that entire procedure can take can be extensive. And if you have an emergent need to enter the United States, it might not be the best way to proceed. What some people are doing, and this has become popular with a lot of Europeans, is even though the land border between Mexico and the United States has closed, some people are using Cancun as a waylay station before entering the United States from Europe. So you can actually fly to Mexico, which doesn't have any restrictions right now on Europeans entered, wait out your 14 days there, and then fly into the United States as long as you have a valid visa. So there are a number of ways to kind of work around these restrictions. Obviously, you shouldn't be engaging in any of these activities if you're not feeling well or your client's not feeling well. But if there is an emergent need, don't think that travel is impossible. It's just very, very challenging right now. The other aspect of the situation where we've really seen a big change is in the processing of visa benefits themselves. The National Processing Center for the United States Immigration Service has resumed activities throughout the pandemic. So you can file for extensions internally. You can still file for extensions of a visitor status. You can file for an extension of employment base. You can still file green card cases. However, there was a recent call from the Department of Homeland Security saying that if USCIS did not receive $1.2 billion in assistance, that the agency, which is a self-funded agency through application fees, would have to furlough 75% of its employees. And if we do move to a furlough situation, a lot of these activities that have been happening at the National Visa Processing Centers will be dramatically curtailed, and wait times will explode in terms of duration. Local offices, where you'll go for like your green card interview or if you have questions about your case, they opened up last week on June 4th. They are, you know, for the most part, taking the health and safety protocols very seriously. They are restricting the amount of people that can enter the building, but they just started running naturalization ceremonies again. The figures, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was something like they normally would process about 500 people for naturalization a week. Now with the reopening of the local offices, they're looking at about 50. So that gives you a sense of like how dramatic they are taking the social distancing requirements when it comes to a naturalization ceremony. We do expect green card interviews and other local office functionality to resume by the end of the month, if not early July. So we are seeing that come back. But yes, it is really going to extenuate processing times. And that's the critical thing. It is really gonna make it much longer. In terms of actual visa processing and benefits, let's say you're like switching an employer and you're on an H-1B visa, there is a mechanism called premium processing where you can pay an additional fee to get the case adjudicated within 15 calendar days. That was suspended when the pandemic went into effect, but that now has eased as well. And as of June 22nd, all types of cases that are authorized for premium processing will have that mechanism back in place. You will be able to use the premium processing service, which will provide some relief. That said, as I mentioned earlier, there is a big push from the government to curtail visas. And there was sort of a leak of some of the proposals that they're suggesting. But the big thing that they're looking at doing is curtailing the entry to the United States of people in H-1B classification, L classification. So H-1B is your typical working visa. L is for intercompany transferees. H-2Bs, which is temporary seasonal work, like people that work down the shore during the summer, and J-1 exchange visitors for training purposes. They're looking at using a section of the law called 212F, which essentially gives the president the power to restrict entry of certain nationals to the United States. So the president has the authorization if it's in the name of national security. The justification is going to be the high unemployment rates, but the president does have the justification to restrict entry. This executive order is really riling up a lot of corporate America who suggest that foreign nationals are of critical importance to the economic recovery of the United States. And the statistics sort of bear this out. If you look at jobs in the tech sector, there's actually been a reduction in the unemployment rates since the start of the pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, unemployment rates for people in the tech sector were hovering around 3%. It's actually dropped to 2.7%. And they feel that curtailing the entry of foreign nationals for these types of jobs will have a dramatic effect. Interestingly, it's estimated that up to 78% of all H-1B visa holders, which is the primary target of a potential executive order, are working in the tech sector. So from an academic perspective, the litigation that most likely will follow after the issuance of the executive order will focus on whether or not the president's justification for curtailing the entry of these immigrants to the United States is truly within the national interest because of the types of jobs that they're filling, because of the role that these jobs have in economic recovery. I can tell you anecdotally, it's not going to have much of an impact because right now with the embassies and consulates being closed to routine visa processing, we already have a de facto ban on people entering the United States. And this is what I was saying during my introduction, that a lot of these decisions seem to be more driven by the political appearance of how they play out rather than the actual economic needs of the United States. For the record, I'm a registered independent. I'm not expressing a political opinion one way or other, but I think it is very fascinating how this plays out. Unfortunately, it has very real consequences. You know, as an immigration practitioner, I'm still dealing with a number of people who are unable to come to the United States, who are unable to reunite with their families because they are on temporary visas. So we will be waiting with bated anticipation as to what will happen with this executive order and the litigation that is going to follow. There is already a restriction in place from an executive order that was levied in early April restricting immigrant visas for certain types of foreign nationals. Immigrant visas are the same thing as a green card. Some most people process those from within the United States, but there are instances where you'll process them abroad for like family members coming to join U.S. citizens or spouses of permanent residents or those who are seeking green cards through employment but aren't physically present in the United States. That ban was initially put into place for 30 days. The expiration of that is coming up soon. And it looks like that is going to, that ban came in early May, but it is looking like that is going to be expanded as well. What is really important to recognize here is that the president's power when it comes to immigration and curtailing immigration is really extraterritorial. So that section of the law that I mentioned before, 212F, is dealing with entry to the United States. It doesn't effectuate individuals currently present. We do anticipate future regulations that will try to change the way the visa system works to favor U.S. workers over foreign nationals. But we do not expect an executive order or an emergency regulation that will impact people's ability to remain in the United States and remain working. These regulatory proposals that will come out will probably have to go through what's known as the rulemaking procedure. So the government will actually issue a rule in the Federal Register, and then there's something called a notice and comment period. And the government is obliged to read all the comments and then address those comments when issuing the final rule. So if you do see a regulation come through regarding immigration that you believe is unfavorable, I highly suggest that you submit a comment, because the more comments you get, the longer it will take them to put the regulation to actual play, and it could delay some of the consequences. But we get a lot of questions from people in the United States who have heard rumors or conjectures about the executive order or have read a tweet from the president or are completely frightened. And I think it's important to assure them that notwithstanding the executive order, We do not anticipate that they will be kicked out of the country. We do not anticipate them putting into removal proceedings. We do not anticipate that extension applications will be denied. We really do feel that this is going to be extraterritorial at first. And then the other question that we get a lot of is, you know, people are getting laid off, and that includes foreign nationals on visas. And there's a lot of questions as to whether or not they'll be required to depart the United States. We have found that switching people to visitor classification because of an inability to travel due to COVID-19 is something that we are able to exercise. And pretty much the message that I'm giving to people that have been laid off or are looking for new work is that we might not be able to ensure your ability to maintain your employment authorization, but we will be able to maintain your ability to remain in the United States without fear of being removed. So I think the challenging issue for immigration attorneys now is there is a lot of uncertainty, there is not a lot of flexibility, and there's a lot of people that find themselves in a very challenging position. I will tell you that my job has changed tremendously since the start of the pandemic. Sometimes it's more like a therapy session when I'm talking to my clients, and I guess that's why they call us counselors. But it really has become as much as dealing with the human impact as to the effects of how the government is handling immigration, as well as their own personal situation and a concern over their long-term livelihood of being able to remain in the United States. However, if the May jobs report is any indication of the direction that the economy is going, where the report was much more favorable than anticipated, if big business continues to push for the importance of immigrants to our community and the need for immigration to help with the economic recovery, I remain hopeful that we will see some positive developments in the ability of foreign nationals to remain in the United States as we start to slowly resume some economic activities. One thing that my firm is committed to, and I extend this, Peter, to you with the Consular Corps and all of our members, is that we are offering free consultations to any foreign national that finds themselves in a rough situation or a company that's concerned with how to handle maybe a reduction in force with respect to their foreign national employees. This is something that we're offering as a free service during this particular time of need. I know that was a lot of information. Hopefully it was digestible. And I think at this time, Eric, it is my distinct pleasure to hand the floor over to Joanne for the next segment.
Yeah, I would just say that for those of you who may have questions for Jonathan, please don't forget you can click on the icon for Q&A, and we'll have those questions ready for him at the end of Joanne and Steve's session. And the same thing for Joanne and Steve. You have questions during their presentation. Once again, please write your questions in the Q&A box or by clicking the icon at the bottom of the screen, and we'll have those answered at the end. So Joanne and Steve, floor is yours.
Okay, thanks, Eric. Obviously, the COVID-19 has had a significant impact on a tax situation in the United States, particularly for resident aliens or non-resident aliens. And there's various classifications for taxpayers in the United States. Obviously, citizens and green card holders are taxed on the worldwide income. And we all know that, and that's what happens, and it's offset with some foreign tax credits. The problem comes whether somebody is a resident alien or a non-resident alien. If you're a resident alien, then you are taxed on your worldwide income just as if you were a green card holder or a citizen. If you're a non-resident alien for tax purposes, you are only taxed on some U.S. source income. And the determination of whether you're a resident or a non-resident is based on the time in the United States. So just to give you a little background, You become a resident alien generally if you're in the United States for 31 days during any calendar year, and the total number of days from the current and two preceding calendar years are at least 183 days. And you measure that by, so if let's take 2020. You count every day you're in the United States in 2020 as one day. Every day that you spent, you count one third of the number of days that you were in the United States in 2019, and one sixth of the number of days that you were in the United States in 2018. And when you add all those up, if you are in the United States for at least 31 days in 2020, but those three years give you 183 days in the United States, you are a resident alien and you are taxed on your worldwide income. Now, that becomes a problem for some people. So now you can understand that where you have the COVID-19 travel restrictions, you can get caught in the United States because while you're going through and then I've got 175 days, I got to get out of the United States or I'm going to be taxing my worldwide income. And all of a sudden, you can't because of the coronavirus. And now you may be stuck with some adverse tax consequences, at least in some people's views. The U.S. has attempted to mitigate these issues by issuing some couple of revenue procedures and some frequently asked questions. Oh, and by the way, all the tax returns that you would normally be due either 4/15 or June 15th, as you probably know already, have been extended to July 15th. And that includes anybody who has an estimated tax payment due for the second quarter, June 15th. That's been moved to July 15th. And the states in the surrounding area have also are following, I believe. Joanne, are the states following the federal?
Or is some states are. Some states are.
Okay. How about the states in this area?
I think they're all 7/15 except for quarterly estimated tax payments.
Yes. Okay. All right. So you've got to check where your resident state. So one of the exceptions to avoid, let's assume that you're in the United States and you're sick and you know you can't travel, you could get in prior years, you always should get a medical travel exception for purposes. So what happens if you were sick during a period of time and that illness, let's say in 2019, you could not travel and get out of the country. And if you stayed in the hospital or the illness that you had required you to be in the United States more than 183 days, if you were able to claim a medical travel exception and reduce that time that you spent in the United States when you were ill so that you could get under the 183 days and therefore you would not be qualified as a resident alien. So that revenue procedure, which is 2020-20, okay, must be a numbers to play, you got to get a travel exception and the purpose of that or the trigger of that is if the COVID-19 related travel issues prevented an individual from leaving the U.S. during the emergency period, which is any 60-day period between February 1st and April 1st, 2020, you would automatically get this medical travel exception. That exception is generally used in addition to and in conjunction with other substantial present exceptions. So many people who are in the United States with 483 days, which would normally be considered a resident alien, there are two other exceptions that many people use. One is the tiebreaker rules under tax treaties, which is basically a closer connection. If you have a closer connection with your home countries, let's say Canada or versus the United States, and it's a check the box thing kind of thing, then you would be treated as a resident. So let's assume you had a closer connection because you had family, you intended to return there, your religious affiliations, driver's license, voting, everything was in Canada, even though you were in the United States 183 days or more than 183 days, you would be treated as a non-resident alien. And then That's under the tax treaties. If you're a resident of a country that doesn't have a tax treaty, there's the closer connection exception, basically under the Internal Revenue Code. It's similar, but not exactly similar to the tiebreaker rules in the under the tax treaties. And if you're claiming either the tiebreaker rules or the closer connection exception, you have to file Form 8843, which with your Form 1040-NR, which is the tax return that a non-resident alien files. The second one, revenue procedure, provides relief to U.S. citizens who are living abroad who elect to exclude foreign earned income and certain housing costs, the so-called 9/11 exclusion. Under this rule, a U.S. citizen who's a bona fide resident of a foreign country that includes an entire year, or is present in a foreign country or countries for at least 330 full days within 12 months, if you would have met those conditions, but you had to leave because you didn't want to get quarantined into the country, and therefore you didn't meet that rule, the revenue procedure that they issued in 20, called 2020-27, would allow you to continue to use that exception, which basically excludes about $100,000 of taxable income from your tax return. And if you left the country of residency by December 1st for China and February 20th, 2020 for all other countries, therefore, then if you had to leave, you would take those days and add it back into the time that you would meet this so-called 9/11 exception. And so there's, now, one thing you got to remember is where you're dealing with the closer, the tax treaties and the tiebreaker rules, you can become a non-resident alien only for the income tax return. So if you have been filing the FBARs, you know, reporting foreign financial assets, even though you would be considered a non-resident alien for tax purposes, if you had the 183-day rule, if you met the 183-day rule, you would still be considered a resident for the FBAR provisions. Now, there are certain provisions, the CARES Act also, you know, has gotten a lot of play, which is the funding for small businesses with less than 500 people, employees. But they also have some tax provisions. But before we get into that, Joanne, you want to just jump in and see if there's anything else that the IRS is doing to solve some of these problems from both businesses and individuals?
Sure. Let me turn on the video. So just an interesting anecdote here. As I was preparing for this presentation last week, my husband is a physician, and he said, "Why are you doing a presentation on COVID-19? What does that has to do with taxes?" He said, "I'm doing a presentation on COVID-19's impact on lung capacity." I said, "Well, you know, taxes has to do with everything. COVID has to do with everything. It has far-reaching consequences beyond what you can imagine." So thank you to Steve and Jonathan for the presentation. COVID-19 travel restrictions not only impact the U.S. tax status of individuals, it also has significant impacts on foreign businesses. Why? Because generally, when a foreign person engages in a trade or business in the U.S., all income from sources within the U.S. connected with the conduct of that trade or business is considered to be what we call effectively connected income, ECI. What does ECI mean? It means a foreign business is conducting some kind of trade or business in the U.S., such as management, production, distribution, or having employees performing services in the U.S. U.S. tax, how does U.S. tax foreign businesses It's really based on income effectively connected with a U.S. trade or business. And what gives rise to the connection of a foreign business is the performance of personal services by the employees. So for example, if you have an Italian company that sends an employee here to visit a vendor in the US or a customer, that does not give rise to a trade or business. That activity, the level of the activity does not rise to the level of a US trade or business. But when you have pandemic-related travel disruptions that left many non-residents stranded in the US, this unplanned US presence is what could have resulted in a company having a US trade or business based on the activities of the stranded employees. So going back to the same example, you have an Italian company that sends an employee here to visit a vendor, a customer. Now he's stranded in, say, California because of shelter in place. He is in a hotel, he is in some kind of accommodation in the US, now performing work. He might be doing analysis for the company, could be doing accounting, could be doing any type of work that is really performance of personal services that is carried on in the US on behalf of a foreign business. And that is really unintended and unplanned, but because of this type of activity that is continuous, regular, and substantial, it could give rise to U.S. taxation of the foreign companies, which normally would not have been subject to U.S. taxes. Steve discussed the Revenue Prof 2020-20. The relief under that RevProc is also extended to determining whether a non-resident business is conducting a U.S. trade or business. The threshold determination of whether a foreign company has a U.S. trade or business is depending on the extent and nature of the activities that they conduct within the U.S., including activities conducted through its employees or agents. And that's where the connection between the foreign business and the U.S. could give rise to U.S. taxation. It's the performance of this, and I repeat this many times, it's really the performance of personal services by the employee on behalf of the foreign business in the United States. The FAQ, which is frequently answer questions, in the RevProc 2020-20 states that foreign companies, foreign partnership will not be treated as engaging in a U.S. trade or business based on the activities of the individuals that are in the U.S. only temporarily because of COVID-19 emergency travel disruptions. So it's a significant relief to avoid U.S. taxation of foreign businesses who have employees that are stranded in the U.S. I think Steve might have discussed this, but I'll just briefly repeat it. For purposes of determining whether a foreign corporation is engaged in a U.S. trade or business, affected entities, meaning foreign corporations that or businesses that have employees in the U.S., may exclude services and activities performed over 60 continuous calendar days beginning between February 1st and April 1st. So if you have an employee that entered the U.S. on April 3rd, this relief would not apply to them. If they enter the U.S. on April 3rd and stay here for 60 days, this relief would not apply. It has to be an entry day beginning between February 1st and April 1st. So what does that mean? What exactly is an individual that is present in the U.S. only on a temporary basis? It is a non-resident alien, someone who's non-U.S., a U.S. resident, or lawful permanent resident who had a tax home outside of the U.S. in 2019 and reasonably expect to have a tax home outside the U.S. in 2020. This is to protect what we call foreign income tax income exclusion of U.S. lawful resident or U.S. citizens that normally would have qualified for the earned income exclusion based on their days of working and living outside of the U.S., but because of the COVID-19, they get stranded in the U.S. So it applies to both non-resident alien and U.S. persons. There is no filing requirement to apply for the relief. You don't have to apply or fill out a form with the IRS to apply for the relief. However, taxpayers really should retain contemporaneous documentation to establish that the activities are only temporary. Activities in the U.S. are temporary. What exactly do you need to retain? What kind of documentation? It could include canceled plane tickets, employee diaries, emails, documentation of published travel restrictions in place in the relevant jurisdictions during the chosen 60-day period, or simply affidavit from employees or management specifying that the activities would not have been conducted in the foreign country, meaning the U.S., but for the COVID-19 travel disruptions. Even though there is no filing requirement to apply for the relief, we would recommend that taxpayers file what we call a protective tax return. Normally, a foreign business would not file a U.S. tax return if they don't have a U.S. trade or business, effectively connected income or permanent establishment in the U.S. But if they have employees in the U.S. that stay here for more than 60 days because of COVID, they may want to file a protective tax return, meaning you file a corporation return, which is a Form 1120F, reporting zero income and zero expenses, and claim that you have no permanent establishment in the U.S. And why is this important that you file this protective return? For three reasons. It preserves the ability to apply the statute of limitations, preserve the ability to claim tax treaty-based relief, and claim deductions against any gross income later on determined to be effectively connected with a U.S. trade or business. The statute of limitation, let's say, going back to the same example, an Italian company sent an employee here to 2020, but in 2021, they actually start a business in the U.S. They establish an office here, they hire an employee here, and the IRS, a couple of years later, reviewed the tax return and said, wait a minute, in 2020, you had an employee here for whatever amount of time, maybe that activities should have given rise to U.S. trade or business. By filing a protective return, it will start the statute of limitation in the year the return was filed. So it would have been 1-1-2020. If the IRS and this statute of limitation would have expired, so you would have filed in 21, 3 years later. Let's say 4 years later, the IRS look at this issue, they cannot go back and said, you should have filed a return reporting U.S. Source income because the statute of limitation for 2020 would have expired. And the other thing that is really important why we are recommending taxpayers to affected taxpayers, meaning again, foreign corporations or businesses that have employees in the U.S. performing services in the U.S., personal services because of COVID, recommending that they file the protective tax return because the tax return, if it's filed 18 months after the due date of the return, you would have to report the income on gross basis. So let's say income is 100,000, that would be the U.S. source income. You cannot claim any deduction against that income if that return was filed 18 months late. So the due date is April 15, 2021, and you file the return 18 months after that, And it was later determined that you actually have U.S. source income in 2020, you would not be able to claim deductions against that income. Deductions such as travel expenses, management fees, or other type of expenses related to the 2020 tax year. And that's why we are recommending the filing of a protective tax return. Steve?
Thanks, Joanne. In addition to the pronouncements and the revenue rulings and some of the FAQs that the IRS has put out, the CARES Act, which is the major legislation dealing with the COVID crisis, did contain several tax provisions. The most far-ranging one to the individual taxpayers is the net operating loss provisions. In the net operating loss provisions, basically in years were changed as a result of the 2017 tax legislation. And before that tax legislation in 2017, income and losses, you know, that flowed through pass-through entities such as S corporations and partnerships directly to the individual's personal tax return had a significant benefit to that individual because when the net operating losses exceeded the other income, the taxpayer's other income, for example, salaries or interest and dividends in any given year, you have an NOL that could be used against other tax years. Now, this rule only applies, doesn't apply to investors. It only applies to people who are active material participant in operating their businesses. So you can't have passive owners or people who are not involved in business don't get any net operating losses. So what happened prior to the 2017 Act, which really affected 2018 and forward, the NOLs could be used immediately to generate a refund. So what would happen is if you had a $500,000 net operating loss, you could carry it back to a given number, back 2 years, get that money, and you would offset some of the economic loss. And the individuals and the states and trusts, if they had that situation, would file a 1045 as soon as they could. And the corporation would file a form 1139 as soon as they could to try to get those that carryback. And if you couldn't use it in the 2 years carryback, so let's assume you were in 19, if you were in 16, because it was before the 17 Act, if you were in 16 and you had a loss, you could carry it back to 15 and 14, get your money relatively quickly, and to offset your economic losses. And if the two prior years didn't have enough income to offset that total loss, you could carry it forward up to 20 years. So people generally, if they wanted the money, they could basically quickly, they used the carry back. And then if they had any excess loss after those 2 years, they would move it forward. They could carry it forward. The 27 legislation basically changed all that. It eliminated the carrybacks. So you couldn't get the carrybacks, which is a cash flow issue. However, the 20-year carry forward limit was removed. So you could carry forward the NOLs for an unlimited number of years. But the carry forward wasn't as valuable as it was in years, because NOLs arising after 2017, you could only offset a maximum 80% of future taxable income. Now, what happened under the CARES Act, they did away with all the changes, basically all the changes that the 17 legislation took care of. So now, and went further. So now, net operating losses generated in years 2018 to 2020 can be carried back for up to 5 years. They're not subject to any limitations, so you can carry back all your income, and you can offset all your income by these losses. And so they are, and the carrybacks have to initially have to be applied to the first eligible year. So if you have a 2020 NOL, you carry it back to 2015. If you don't use it all up, you don't have enough income in 2015, you move it to 2016 and keep moving forward. And if you don't have enough income to eliminate many of your losses that arose in 2020, then you can carry it forward. And it's important because they're using the tax law to go back for 5 years to generate cash flow for people who have had substantial losses. And you can imagine that many businesses, you know, that small businesses, you know, or even large, you know, many large businesses, unless they're publicly traded, are carried on through partnerships or S corporations. And so many of these people need the money to move forward, to pay their employees, to restock their shelves with inventory, and to try to get a healthy business moving forward. So, and they've used that to do through the tax law. Now, so for example, if you were a taxpayer and you had $3 million of taxable income in 2015, and $5 million of taxable income in 2016, but you generate a $4 million net operating loss in 2020, you can file Form 1045 in 2021, which would be your normal filing year, normal year that you would file for 2020, and you apply that NOL against 2015. So if you apply it against 2015, $3 million of that NOL are used up and you'll get a refund on the tax on $3 million, whatever you paid in 2015. And that additional $1 million you then apply to 2016 and you recalculate your tax basically as if you have a $1 million loss in 2016 and you will get a tax refund. And they generally, these tax refunds can be done relatively quickly and the government pays them pretty quickly. So in 2021, you'd get the tax that you paid on basically $4 million of income in 2015 and 2016. You actually can elect to relinquish your five-year carryback. Once you make that decision, it's irrevocable. But you may be better off carrying it back because the tax rates were higher back then and the brackets were wider. So you would probably recapture more money if you go back to 2020, go backwards and then forwards rather than relinquish your carryback and do everything going forward. Got to keep in mind that it has some extenuating circumstances. So if you're applying for a refund on an NOL carryback, there's always a chance that year would be closed, but it opens it up and you might have some other things on that return that you'd rather, you know, that may be questionable or you'd rather not be deal with. So here the government under the CARES Act is using both, you know, the carryback both for the individuals and as Joanne will talk about as for corporations to generate excess cash to mitigate the real economic losses that people will suffer in 2020. Joanne, you want to touch base with any other issues on the CARES Act? Might help in businesses?
Sorry, technical difficulty. Eric, are we out of time?
Yeah, we're close to the time. Yeah, we're pretty close.
Very, very close. We need to open it up for questions. So see if someone has any questions.
I don't have any comment on the CARES Act, but I do want to make one final comment about how COVID-19 affects businesses on the state level. It's not just a federal issue, it's also a state issue. Think of our company, Drucker & Scacchetti, we are based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We have, the company has, or employer has income tax withholding obligations based on where the business perform its services, where the business conducts its operations. So because of COVID, we have employees working from home, New Jersey, Delaware, New York, you know, different places. Some might even have gone home to their parents and stay with their parents. The same concept of the employees performing services in the US on behalf of foreign corporations might give rise to US taxation, also apply to state income taxes for the employees and for the employers also. But I want to talk more about the employees here. If you have a foreign company that has employees performing work in Pennsylvania, California, that could also give rise to state income tax implications for both the company or the businesses and the employees. I'm not going to delve too much into this. We're running out of time, but it is something that we have to keep in mind. It's not just federal taxes. It's also state tax implications. Some states have come out with the guidance that they will institute nexus relief provisions similar to federal that would provide some kind of safe harbor to waive the state withholding tax liabilities. Some of these states are Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Mississippi. I would expect that in the next couple of months, more states will come out with guidance that would be similar to the federal relief under 2020-20. I think that's all I have. It concludes my portion of the presentation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all. I don't have anyone who has submitted a question, but very quickly, I want to open the floor to see if anyone wants to verbally ask a question. I'll let them raise their hand in the participants box, and I will then I'll unmute and allow you to speak so that you can ask your question of any of the panelists. If not, then we can wrap up. But let's give it a minute to see if anyone has any questions.
Peter has a question.
There you go, Peter.
Oh, he has to unmute, though.
You have to unmute yourself there.
I'm just going to unmute myself. Can you hear me? This is for
Jonathan. Yes.
Jonathan, I just received an email from the Consul General of Panama, here, a member of our organization. A wonderful representative of that country, Georgia Athanasopoulos. And she was informing me that she's been working very hard in terms of organizing flights to repatriate Panamanian citizens. And I just wondered, I'm not sure, I mean, obviously we've all heard about examples of that, but I wonder what the visa and sort of documentation implications of those special flights represent.
So when they're talking about the repatriation, they're essentially talking about taking Panamanians who are in the United States and bringing them back to Panama. So, you know, hopefully they'll have passports so they can travel out of the U.S. Where things get a little bit tricky, Peter, and where you have to watch out is what is the underlying status of the individual in the United States, and whether or not a departure back to the home country will affect their ability to return to the United States when the pandemic subsides. So, you know, as far as just leaving the US because it is a Panamanian citizen returning to Panama, I don't really see any US immigration issues on its surface, but those are the types of scenarios, honestly, where people walk themselves into problems because they might not be able to come back later. And, you know, that's something that's very real, especially as we keep in mind the discussion we had earlier about the presidential proclamation that we're expecting in the near future.
Thank you.
It's a good question.
Very helpful.
And, you know, honestly, Peter, I just want to reiterate before it looks like we're going to shut down here that honestly, if any of the constituents or members from the Consular Corps have any immigration questions, and I don't mean to speak on behalf of my friends, Joanne and Steve, but you know, we are here to help. I mean, this is one of those times where we all have to band together and use our collective knowledge to benefit the members of our community. And my firm is committed to that and would be honored to assist in any way possible.
And maybe I will make a closing comment since we have maybe a minute. And it is only to maybe recognize that we're experiencing a unique moment in history in which the entire world is facing a common enemy. And obviously there's other examples that over our entire history where that may have happened, but rarely to this extent. And I think that creates, I like to think it creates, a rare opportunity for global cooperation and communication and coordination and connectivity and all the positive things that can come out of this common experience. So thank you all very much, because this kind of information contributes to that general understanding at a global level. So thank you very much, panelists.
Thank you.
All right, folks, if we seem to not have any questions, so with that, I'm going to wrap up. I'm going to thank our panelists, Jonathan, Joanne, and Steve. Thank you, Peter, and the members of the Consular Corps for allowing us to come and share this information. And we wish everybody a healthy rest of the day and stay safe out there. And that should be it.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.